Pre-Loved Radio, a podcast sharing inspirational stories about pre-loved fashion.
Hey, re-lovers, welcome back to our conversation about women, fashion, and consumerism. If you're just joining us, I'm Chrissy Dunn, your host, and this is part two of our three-part series. If you haven't had a chance yet, we highly recommend going back and listening to part one, where we talked about the challenges of consumption habits and the impact of fast fashion on women and the environment. It's pretty much the foundation for today's conversation, so definitely go and check that one out. Today, we're talking about why we buy and looking at the relationship between our mental state and our consumption habits. Before we jump in, let's quickly reintroduce our panelists. Gentle coach Viv Oldham, money coach Jacinta Ebsworth, slow fashion advocate Charlie Smith, and sustainable fashion expert Hazel Law. I want to start today's conversation with social media marketing because it plays such a pivotal role in the fast fashion industry, and it's something that we're all bombarded with pretty much 24/7. I'd love to hear from you, Charlie, particularly on social media and the convenience of one-click shopping.
So I think the biggest one is that these fast fashion houses are being involved in events such as Coachella, Splendor in the Grass, and all of these like big events that already are so good at making you have that sense of FOMO, that immediately now, the way that they do it with that one-click thing is they'll go one click for the Coachella edit, one click for the Splendor in the Grass edit. So immediately these fast fashion brands were capitalizing on that and the need for, when you go into these events, to consume a large amount of products just to make a choice of one outfit you're going to wear. I don't know if you've ever seen the videos of girls when they're like, I'm trying on all my options for Groove in the Moo, and they would have like 10 outfits and all the outfits still had their tags on them and they were all from these big fast fashion houses. And it wasn't like they were just already in their wardrobe and they're saying, okay, I'm going to shop within my wardrobe and find something. They're going, oh, and it's not for 2 weeks. So if you want any of these outfits, click the link and click that now. And immediately it's there. And that these fast fashion houses are so smart at being able to see what's going on in their audience's sphere, whether there's events coming up, seasonal changes, any kind of opportunity to have, give people that quick turnover. If you type in bridesmaid dress on any of these fast fashion brand outlets, I guarantee there will be some sort of like a sale dress that you can get, and they'll offer you that express shipping that you can get, so it's at your door in 2 days' time. And it's so accessible that it's like, how is any sort of ethical and local brand supposed to compete with that? Like, really? Because at the end of the day, if say I have an event that has come up for Wednesday, I do have an event on Wednesday. If I wasn't someone who already shopped within my wardrobe and, you know, shop sustainably, I'm actually at the moment doing a no buy freeze as well. I could easily jump onto one of those big fast fashion houses and pick two different things to order it to my house and have them here by tomorrow afternoon. And anything I didn't like, I could send back. And that's also the problem. You can just send back things you don't want and get a refund.
It really is so easy. Too easy. Hazel, tell us how this kind of marketing leads to unsustainable shopping habits.
When it really comes down to it, unsustainable consumption is born from the position of wanting to really fit in and be part of something that's bigger than ourselves. So the way that plays out in our kind of secular societies nowadays is it shows up in overconsumption. It's what we might have outsourced to religion or spirituality or that kind of like inner work in previous generations. It's now the go to consume, like we were saying last week. And there's this amazing podcast by Amanda Lee McCarty called The Clothes Horse Podcast. And she, in her words, she says that fashion thrives on the feeling of being left out. So everything that fashion marketing is, social media, fashion marketing, and the two are inextricably linked at this point in our lives. They use all of these strategies to make us feel less than. So that's the comparison piece, competition, exclusion, inequality, financial instability, and then preying on our self-esteem. So all of those things really lead to make us feel othered and less than. And once we're feeling less than and othered, we want to buy more. So as long as they're continuing to make us feel unworthy, we'll keep buying. And luckily for capitalism, we can, because capitalism and the fast fashion model is built on this infinite growth. It's why companies can lose money when they are creating ultra fast fashion. So like stuff like purchasing way too many units of each garment to get the lowest price possible. A lot of the units that are actually made of the clothes that we buy are then destroyed or sent to landfill because there were always too many to be sold, but it was so that company could get that bottom line figure from the factory that they're using. But the company's book looks like it makes a profit. Like the board and the stakeholders are happy with that. But the world isn't created for infinite growth. The planet is not created for infinite growth. It's not. It only works if the only thing that we want to have is the profit of money. And obviously that's not working for us. Yeah. So I've got a few more things to say on that. But yeah, so basically... The people making our clothes and the people that are consuming the clothes are not happy because essentially what is being created is future rubbish. Like they are creating clothing that we are consuming at an absolutely ridiculous rate that actually has obsolescence built into those pieces. So it's built to break down. It's built not to last, which only leaves us in a position where we feel like we have to buy more because we have such a low consumer cost that actually those pieces don't feel like it doesn't feel profitable or financially sensible for us to alter them or to get them repaired because they were so cheap to buy. And yeah, just going back to the question, the kind of unsustainable consumption habits, we're really at the whim of social media, I would say. Like there's more than 3.5 billion people that use these free, quote unquote, free meta platforms such as Facebook or Instagram. But like, if we don't pay for the product, we are the product. And what is being, you know, mined from us using these social media platforms is our data. And that data goes to these companies and it's overwhelmingly fast fashion websites or like websites like Vogue that have these tracking systems on there that then will like track us across the internet, what we look at, how long we look at it, what we're looking at before we start to buy stuff so that they can actually push those things on us. And like we live in a world where we don't have a gap between desire and purchasing anymore. So I've been reading Good With Money by Emma Edwards, and she says that because buying has become so easy for us, we just don't have any time to debate with ourselves if we really need something or we're just experiencing this fleeting desire. So we're going on social media, we can go from seeing, swiping, purchasing and moving on within a matter of minutes without even a second thought, which is what creates this mindless consumption and more mindless consumption than ever before and therefore more overconsumption than ever before.
And it's not even a matter of minutes, yeah. Really.
Seconds, yeah.
Seconds. It is seconds. If you have your details saved into your phone, it's literally three taps and you've purchased something. And it's that instant gratification, like it is actually instant.
And it's so impulsive. I was thinking as you were talking, Hazel, I've seen a few people do this in the online course space where they actually encourage people to slow down before purchasing. And I deeply respect it. I'm like, thank you for bringing that to my attention. And so you're not just buying on impulse. Mm. It's like in the terms and conditions where it says we encourage you to slow down and to consider if this is the right thing for you before you purchase. So it's nice to know that while some aspect of culture is funneling us into the impulse to buy, there are people out there who are recognizing, who are being counterculture and saying, hey, slow down. It's just not in fashion yet.
Well, what's interesting in that, Viv, is that from fashion, like in fashion and fashion history, there is always the anti-fashion. There has to be. And it's what happens behind the scenes when something is so strongly in the kind of forefront of what we're seeing, like whether it's on the catwalks or whether it's wherever, the counterculture is what's happening behind the scenes. And that is what reacts to the mainstream culture, and it always happens. I think that is what's so important, because without that kind of like pull and shove, that's not the right terminology, but you know, without that like give and take, there is just one homogenized world, and that's not what we can't live like that.
And what are some of those tricks that the fast fashion brands use to make us feel that sense of urgency and the fear of missing out or FOMO when we're shopping?
So I would say the tricks that they use is everything is really immediate. All the sales, I tend to notice that on the websites, there tends to be like a countdown timer. Have you ever seen that on websites, how it's like the countdown timer to when the sale ends? But have you ever noticed that the next day the sale's back on and it's another 48 hours, but it's an even bigger sale this time, to the point where I'm starting to think the original price never actually occurred. If that makes sense, like they're just, everything's always on sale, and that timer is like immediately planting that urgency in your brain. You need to buy now and you need to make that choice now, instead of thinking about it and thinking about the consumption and thinking about whether you actually need that piece or whether you like it or whether you want to look, you know, is it on your Pinterest board of things that you're, you know, been wanting to buy for a while. Like they've got that timer and you're going, the bomb's about to go off. I'm about to miss out. I'm about to have that FOMO of that insane sale. Or even now noticing that brands are doing it when they're launching. There's like such a big countdown, kind of like literally a representation of numbers is immediately there. So it's going, here's the problem in marketing 101. Here's the solution to solve it. But instead of just solving it in general, you have to solve it by the end of the 48-hour sale. And a lot of the time, what they also do is, as someone who's been on the other side of it, when you are involved in influencer campaigns, is often you're told to post while the countdown's on. So post this weekend. And the best one is you used to get told to post your discount code within like a 12 hours of the sale ending. So it was that urgency that you are then putting onto people and go, well, you've only got 12 hours left. If you want this jacket I'm wearing, it's 70% off. You don't even realize that you're being manipulated. And then from there, you're manipulating others into having that FOMO as well.
Yeah. So I'd say that fast fashion marketing basically lives, breathes, and expands on the idea of scarcity and exclusivity. So basically, the scarcity piece is so dangerous because they are encouraging us to always buy now. And we were talking about Shein, and they've doubled their profits to $2 billion. And so that figure alone from that one company tells us that clearly there isn't a shortage of items. Like there are items everywhere, but the illusion that they are selling us is that there is a scarcity of either the piece that we want. So it kind of sells us the idea in a few ways. And it also creates a state of this cognitive dissonance, because even when we've seen the images of the tons and tons and tons of fabric and clothing in landfill, we still somehow buy into the fact that this one piece that we need is, you know, not ever going to be available again or from anywhere else, secondhand, or, you know, that the cyclical trends that we know will roll around, we feel in that moment.
Is that also like if someone was to run a limited edition series of things?
Yeah, so I was actually going to say, so Zara are like number two, oh, well, say in the like traditional fast fashion, right? So we've got ultra fast fashion now and fast fashion. So, and the way that they do that, or one of the really clever ways that they do that, is they only keep a very small amount of stock in store. So when you go in, you think, oh, there's only like 6 of these tops or 10 of these tops. They look amazing. Like I have to buy it now because they're not going to be, they're going to run out. But all it is behind the scenes, they're just like constantly air shipping these clothes from all over the world to this one spot, this one airstrip where I think it's in Turkey, but don't quote me on that. And then they ship out very, very small batches to all of their stores to create this illusion in store that there's a scarcity of their clothing. Like, but it's all an illusion. Like it's just very clever, very evil marketing, really. And then they kind of sell us that in a few different ways. So like trends, obviously, like trends are pretty much just there to convince us that we need to be on trend. And it's a really good way of getting us to dispose of clothes that are perfectly good to replace them with clothes that are just as good. Like it's just a trick Like, it's a trap, really. And we've also been conditioned to believe that old is bad. And that's kind of in more ways than one. So, like, telling a woman that she's, like, if she's wearing, say, skinny leg jeans, that's, like, dating her. That's telling everyone how old she is. That's telling everyone that she's a millennial, that she needs to basically, like, move with the time. So that's going to motivate a woman, more to buy something on trend, because we don't want to appear to be old, because we've been fed this, like, lie that aging is a bad thing rather than the privilege that it is.
Yeah.
We can all probably relate to using shopping as therapy at some stage in our lives. Why do we do that? What emotions are driving those impulsive shopping behaviours?
Oh, okay. I want to say it's that inner perfectionist, that most of the time people are going to these online shopping platforms for comfort. Feeling textures and having that sensory experience with garments in person can often be like a self-soothing behavior. I mean, we see it in children, but we also do see it in ourselves. Like wearing, when you feel sick, you put on comfortable clothes, you put on a comfortable fluffy jumper and fluffy tracksuit pants. If you're feeling emotionally vulnerable, it's not a surprise that you reach for garments that feel nice in your hands. I mean, if you look at the clothing you reach for when you're unwell or not feeling very well emotionally, it's very different to when you're feeling anguish or feeling upset. Like, it's very different. And I think that mostly with online, people reach for it for that comfort and feel that sense of fulfillment and that little bit of emptiness. It can, you know, be when we're feeling the comparison between ourselves and the life that we want, or the comparison of where we are now versus where we used to be or where we want to be. And immediately it's that feeling of inadequacy that we tend to have in ourselves and that relationship to self that we tend to go and seek out in these online platforms, clothing stores, that we're not meeting our own needs or our needs aren't being met. So we go and find something else to fill it.
There's a sense of satisfaction from taking action. So when we purchase, if we're feeling like we're a bit, say, overwhelmed, out of control, not making progress, there's also a sense of being able to take action and do something rather than being with whatever feelings we're experiencing. So it's this slippery slide into not only getting that dopamine hit from thinking about the purchase and actually making the purchase, but this sense of actually doing something. So they're sort of feeding into that need to feel like I'm doing, like I'm achieving, yes, like I'm making progress. Yeah. If I'm not feeling good in my body, well, at least I'm doing something about it. And then that's an easier thing to do than sit with the discomfort of, why am I needing that? Why am I feeling like I need that? That, I mean, that's a hard question to be with.
Absolutely. Well, at the end of the day, part of the human condition is craving control. We're always seeking things that we can control. And one thing that we often have the most control of is the way that we dress ourselves. And then stepping further into that, how we consume before we dress ourselves. So when we don't feel a sense of control in our lives, of course, we're going to turn to a shop where we can pick how we dress our body in. If we feel a sense of stress and we feel as though everything else in our sphere is out of control, well, what can we control? We can control the clothes we put on our body. So let's go spend some money. Or you even notice when people can't control things, they eat more. So they control what they're putting in their body, or they eat less. But that's not for this. That's not for this conversation. I am not a psychologist, so that's not for me to comment on. But there's so many aspects of our lives that we crave, and we crave that control. And actually, I've got a book on this. It's called Everything is Fucked, and I love it. And it's a book about hope. And one of the things that he talks about is the paradox of progress. And that right now, the place that we're in and the space in this world, we're actually in one of the best times to be alive. Because, which, you know, it sounds pretty crazy thinking of it, because we have all the medical advancements we've ever need for everything to go well. We have technological advances that get better and better each day. We are better at communicating. Our education is getting better and better. We're in one of the times where we have the most rights as a female on paper. On paper, I'm going to preface that with. But what the paradox of progress is that with all of that, we're actually in a time where most people feel the most lonely and most depressed that they've ever felt in their life. And realistically, what we are doing from that is we're now craving more and more self-control, and we're craving a control on our environments and our spheres, which we don't regularly have because everything is just progressing faster than we can keep up with. We have these two parts of our brains. We have the logical brain, we have the emotional brain. And with that, when our emotional brain is craving something, our logical brain steps in with a solution and steps in with a comfort. And I think at this day and age and in this society, one of the main things that we do, and especially as women, we tend to do is we tend to go to clothing stores or online stores and occupy ourselves with things and possessions and objects to cure that lack of self-control and lack of hope in our own world.
And moving towards an aspirational identity.
And an unachievable aspirational identity. Like, it's always going to be elusive. It's never going to be, oh, this is it now.
But it comes back to the dream, doesn't it? It comes back to the dream that they're selling us.
Yeah, absolutely. And the illusions that the whole industry is built upon. It's crazy.
What about from a financial viewpoint, Jacinta? How do you think that social media is driving this impulsive spending?
Speaking to what Hazel said, people need to understand, like, it was a quote from the documentary, The Social Dilemma, and if you're not paying for the product, which is using the platform like Instagram, then you are the product. And for people to understand that, so it's so accessible to us because it's at your fingertips. And I think from a deep understanding about marketing, they personalize the marketing messages to you, like they're tailored specifically to the individual in their algorithm. So they know, in quote bracket, what you're looking for from your search history, your activity, what's trending, what messages they pick up on your phone. Like, they tailor the message to you. So it can seem for some people like destiny, air quotes, if you see the outfit you want and you keep seeing it everywhere, though, like you see it on different platforms and the ads running in your email, on your social media, and it's like it's haunting you. So you're like, oh, that's what I was looking for. How did it know? But it's perfectly designed to work this way. And it said that social media provides people with like an ideal opportunity to compare themselves with others online. So the other rise that I've seen in the 10 years, because I got into social media for like the food pics and like when I was living overseas and I would like review places and post pictures. But what didn't exist then that is now is the influencer impact. So fashion influencers encourage people to lean into their consumer behavior. Like, they do these brand hauls and what I'd wear to, and they get you to survey, like, I've got a wedding coming up, and they just have 10 or more dresses to just try on, which is crazy, but it's like kind of makes it into it. Like, you're there with your friend trying on clothes, like in a change room, and then they'll post links to where they got things. And it's just very encouraging. It's personable, but it's obviously on like a global scale, and that's definitely something that people just need to understand. Like, it's not magic, it's marketing, and the algorithm is dictated by you. So in terms of that, like, you have tools to utilize. Like, you can block pages, you can block keywords so they don't come up in your feed. Like, you can curate your feed to sort of better align with your goals and what you want. Like, if you want to cut down on spending or seeing certain things, like, you can block ads, you can turn off suggested posts, but you have to sort of be proactive in how you want to approach using social media for yourself if you need like limitations on impulsive spending.
I think it comes down to that first point of call, like you say, Jacinta, that the first thing is, how am I distracting myself? Like, with social media, period.
Yeah. Like, what am I going in here for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I constantly delete the app from my phone when I'm like, it's a bit too much on the reels, young lady. And it's wild, like, how different you feel. Not like, I go to my phone, I'm like, oh, there's nothing to look at. Close it.
Yeah.
Like,
I.
But you still keep picking it up.
Yeah. And I find.
And checking the bank account. That hasn't moved. Yeah.
It's that impulsivity. For even just pressing the screen of the phone. seeking that dopamine hit of like, oh, there's a message. Mm. Like you say, checking the bank account or checking the, it's so habitual, email checking, the social media checking.
Yeah, the impulse to check.
For the dope, going, looking for the dopamine hit. There was something really fascinating and I was trying to find the book earlier, but it was, I think it's called Dopamine or Dopamine something or other. Sorry that I don't have the actual book name, but it was talking about the fact that you're already getting the dopamine hit. As soon as you decide I'm going to get onto social media, you're already receiving a dopamine hit before you even get onto it. Or if I decide I'm going to eat a chocolate bar, you're actually already getting a dopamine hit before you eat the chocolate bar.
Yeah, and so the dopamine is around the desire. Yeah.
And we're seeking out this kind of this fashion. And we're sort of encouraged to be seeking it out constantly externally, like everything externally. I can't create that for myself within the wardrobe that I have. There's a sense somehow in the Western culture that we're all living in that we get that from outside of ourselves. There's no one saying go inward and explore what you already have, except for you, Hazel.
It's me. No, but you're absolutely right. It's like we're outsourcing our sense of identity because that's essentially what clothes are, because they're so closely linked to our, you know, they're our second skin. They are how we portray ourselves in the world. And we are outsourcing our own identity to fashion marketing.
And that's about part of a bigger picture, a bigger conversation of outsourcing our own wisdom to experts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting what you were saying about social media and the dopamine hit, because I notice in myself when I'm having a particularly tough time with my children, like if I'm having a day where everyone is just screaming, I'll just look at my phone. So I'm like, I just need some like mental peace from you guys. And like, it's not offering me anything other than really more screaming because they're going to be upset that I'm not paying them 100% attention. But I'm like, I get into that habitual space where I'm like, I need 3 minutes to look at my phone so that I can just completely disassociate with what's actually happening.
And that's the nervous system thing, right? Mm. So the nervous system's flooded.
Yeah.
And it's like, what can I do that is, and it's so easy, it's so accessible. I can check out in this way and then we might get served something like Jacinta was talking about, that's the algorithm serves us something and then it's like, oh, I've checked out, but then I've been served something that's going to give me a feeling of whatever that positive feeling is. And of course, because we're not only are we trying to check out from something that's felt like it's too much, and then we get offered something that's going to make us feel satisfied or like we've achieved something or we ticked that off the list. We got the shoes that I was really wanting. Oh, that will make me feel like less bedraggled.
I love the word bedraggled, motherhood and bedraggled.
So bedraggled is like my middle name.
I also wonder if when we were talking about like the achievement, like I've done something, wonder if that's an essence of like Hazel's, like you go to it for a distraction, but maybe you find like a piece of info on there, like someone telling you something about nervous system regulation. So you actually feel like, even though I went on to Instagram, I found something that could be beneficial to me. So it wasn't a total waste of time. So it's like a mini achievement.
Or I feel seen. Someone shares something and they're also scrolling social media because their kids in that moment were too much. And I'm like, oh, I feel seen. So that whole piece around that Hazel talked about around really it's tapping into the desire to belong, the desire the desire to be something other than what we are right now. So that aspirational identity stuff, they're nailing it.
And I love that thing that you said, Jacinta, about it being like this mystical, like apparition of what we were searching for, because I think there are a lot of people, myself included, that look at the world like that. And, you know, some might say that's foolish, but I have gotten so far in my life thinking, yep, things are like coming to me in signs. I got this. And then, like you say, the algorithm serves you something and you're like, oh, it's like, yes, the universe is confirming my desire for X, Y, and Z or whatever it is. And the way, because I'm still doing my wardrobe freeze, the way that I've really tried to decouple that in my mind is that like I just say this isn't for me, like this message from social media or wherever it is isn't for me, this marketing message isn't for me. And I just kind of have tried to like mentally shut that piece of my brain down that's receptive and looking for those pieces so that I can continue with my wardrobe freeze and not be distracted because it's so such an important goal for me.
A topic that's come up recently is compulsive buying disorder and how it overwhelmingly affects women. Why do you think that is?
It's like still back to dopamine and like seeking some sort of reward system, and it's fleeting. Like you're just constantly chasing a temporary high. It's temporary. It's short term. There's nothing long term. They can't fathom beyond. And I'd say, if I'm going to speak to women specifically, the space I come from, I feel like we're conditioned to think about short term things like getting married, having a wedding, and then like kids. But my fear for women is like retirement age, and like that's long term. So it's further away for some. And like thinking about the plannings of that, that's not really a fun thing to get a high from. Like that's not instant. And you're in a compulsive buying set, you're not thinking about it. And I know personally, friends with older mothers are in situations in their retirement era and are not prepared because, I'm not saying necessarily about compulsive buying, but just like it wasn't a conditioning for us to think about, because back to what I said in the last episode, my princess theory, I think we're just conditioned to think you'll meet a man and then be like cared for. And that's not really that change generationally from like our mothers to like a millennial. And like we've all been working like most of our lives, except for if you pause career breaks for caring and for children and things like that. But I think we're not conditioned to think long term. So like I think that feeds into the compulsive buying because it's temporary. And I still think like what I advocate for is empowering women to understand how money works, how it works for them. Because I think the conditioning, actually the old patriarchy and capitalism, is like we didn't have to think about it. And it's not fun to think about. And it's like you'll be looked after. But I think we were just kind of shown earning money is to have fun with it. Travel, shop, have fun. I don't think we were taught enough about like the practical side. And then again, like generationally, if your mom stayed at home, didn't earn an income, didn't have super, maybe my parents didn't even own a house. So like it comes hard and fast. Like when reality hits, when you are just ill prepared for like the realistic things you need. Because being able to buy outfits, it can be fun, but like it's not a skill.
And it's in the present.
Like it's not.
Yeah, it's like it's
current.
The present.
That's what I mean. Short term.
And I think
what
I have come to understand is that perhaps generationally, certainly, this has been my experience. This very noticing an inability to be in the gap between where I am now and where I would like to be, and if I can't tolerate being in that gap, then I'm going to be looking for ways to make being in that kind of that space, that kind of liminal space where I don't know, it's going to take work and oh my God, it looks so far away where I want to be, which is having money for retirement or whatever it is. How will I make myself feel okay? Okay, I'm probably more likely to do that impulsive buying, or there's going to be things to try to make myself feel good in the discomfort of getting there.
Because you have to get there.
And I think you might liken it to helping kids to be with frustration in the learning process. It's such a it's such an important point in learning, but it's a really uncomfortable place to be. And like you said, we've been encouraged to kind of enjoy life, enjoy the moment, be in the moment, live for the now. There's so many catchphrases that you could look at, like you're worth it, that don't encourage savoring what we have, cherishing what we have. I had this memory as Hazel was talking earlier about when I was 16 and I was incredibly lucky. I got the opportunity to go to a trek through Nepal, and we were in the mountains of Nepal, and I remember very distinctly this moment of seeing this family. They were living in relative poverty, I suppose I would say, but they were radiant, and they had this bowl that the mother was dry. And I thought to myself, holy fuck, we've got it all wrong. Like, look at them, radiant, happy, taking such care of the few things that they have. And it's this moment that I've come back to again and again when I find myself going into consumer consumption mode. It's like at 16, I witnessed someone with very little looking incredibly content and taking care of the small things that they had. And it's quite a kind of profound image that I've taken with me through my whole life and come back to.
And we're not taught that.
No, we're just not taught to cherish. And there's no relationship. That's another thing to consider. So when we're buying, we actually haven't developed a relationship with it. So when you grow something from the ground and then you get to eat it, it's like, fuck, this is awesome. Because you've nurtured it and you've been relating with it.
Mm.
Or if you make your own, knit your own jumper, or you knit your own socks, the sense of satisfaction that you have when you pull those socks on is something that is so different to the sense of satisfaction. I wouldn't even say you get a sense of satisfaction when you're doing the impulse buying. It's so different.
There's a really good book. I've not finished reading it yet. I am making my way through it very slowly, by Tara Button, and it's called A Life Less Throwaway.
Mm.
And a lot of what I've read so far does focus on what you were saying about cherishing what we own.
Yeah. And just understanding that we haven't learned to cherish because it's been seen as like an indulgent, or there's a fear, oh my God, then I'll be turned into a hedonist who is only seeking pleasure. Or there's a lot of fear around pleasure and things being pleasurable.
When things aren't made with quality, aren't made with care, because we have sort of like finance and money in our society, that when we're buying something that doesn't cost that much money, why should we value it? Why should we care about it? Why should we feel like it was an achievement and feel like we should have a connection to it and look after it when it costs $5? The whole system is created in a way that, like, why care? Why care anyway? Like, it's just so, it's really sad.
I'd really like to know, what are some practical tips or some strategies for what we can do instead?
Sit with the feeling that you have. Sit with the feeling and look at what is that garment? What does it represent? And why do I feel the need to buy the mini leather skirt? What's the feeling I'm looking for? What's missing within me, or I feel like it's missing within me, that's stopping me from being that? And why do I want that so badly? Because there's so many layers to what we want and what we desire. And when we look deep at what those are, usually the answer is really simple. It might be that a lot of the time it tends to be confidence. And that's the thing that the influencer market has really picked up on, is it's capitalizing on people with confidence to sell to people that lack confidence. Because if you're missing that part of your self-confidence, that part of your own self-worth, and you see it on someone and they're also trying to sell you something, you are so much more inclined to buy it. So sit with yourself and say, what do they have that I'm missing? And how do I give it to myself without it actually costing me anything?
That is such an interesting perspective, because I've never thought about it that way in terms of the confidence aspect.
My biggest perspective on that changed when I started seeing some of the clothes we were being sold and going, I don't even like that. Like, I'm not a fan of that certain clothing garment, but that girl that's wearing it just looks so cool. But why do I want it? Oh, I want how cool she looks. I want her confidence.
Yeah.
So really, I could wear something completely different that feels more reflective of me. But if I pretended for 5 minutes that I was her, I bet that skirt would look even better on me, because I've got the confidence. I think we need to think more about, instead of buying a product, it's stepping into a different level of confidence and finding that within ourselves first, which is hard. It's easier said than done. But if you're noticing a pattern, figure out where you can get that confidence from. It can be in sitting down and trying a new makeup tutorial with the stuff you already have, or cooking a beautiful meal or stepping outside or spending time with friends. It can come from so many different places. It doesn't have to come from a click and an exchange of funds. Mm. It comes from inside, and you have to want it and you have to be ready to face that. And you can spend forever doing it and finding it, but you've got to really want to move it yourself.
I'm sure I said it last time. I think one of the biggest things that has helped me personally is that as soon as I get an impulse to purchase, and I use this and I say this because I suffered from an eating disorder for decades, and I needed to slow down the urge to binge. And it's a similar, not the same, kind of addiction when we're going to do the impulse buying. So for me, it was always slowing down and going, well, what's the feeling? What's the feeling I'm having? And what's the need? What am I needing? And even just asking myself those two questions. And there's some really wonderful resources on the Center of Nonviolent Communication around, you know, like universal needs and also feelings when our needs are not being met and feelings when our needs are being met that you can print out and you can look at and you can be like, how do I develop my nuance and my language around feelings and needs so I get a better sense of what is going on?
I think that's really valuable. And also just into what you said before about taking those physical steps of blocking the ads. I know you said that you remove the apps from your phone. Did you have any specific recommendations for apps? Or I know you mentioned ad blockers as well. Tell me about that.
Well, so people can understand, like, you have the power to curate your feed. So I just think it's really important to understand you can block suggested ads. You can block keywords if you're like, for things that you don't want to see. And then I'd also say adding on that, yeah, finding a list of questions to ask yourself. Do I need this? Do I have something like this already? Can I wear this on rotation in my wardrobe? Could I borrow it from someone to see if I like it first? And another thing in terms of slowing down, like, don't save your details anywhere, your card details, because once you have to, oh no, how annoying. Oh, I still do it. Like, I don't have my details saved, so I have to get up, get my wallet. Still need to buy tickets for things, but it's like there's an answer. I got a timer. I got to, like, you have to slow down. And so I think it helps. Like, I don't do the PayWave. I like to get the card out. It just helps me physically remember, because otherwise I will just be spending more so. And that's like knowing yourself. So knowing what helps you is huge. And then I ask myself, like, in terms of shopping, like, does this impact my short and long-term goals? Because that's important. And then also, like, will I remember this tomorrow? Like, will I be thinking about this tomorrow, next week, or next month, or next year? And then also, like, crucial is, what am I feeling? And when was the last time I felt like this? Maybe it's not even related to necessarily shopping. Like, it could be another time. And then, like, speaking to nervous system regulation, like, what can I do to regulate? And then a huge one is, changing your whole outfit. You can just change your hair, because you can put something else on it when you have new hairdo. Everything looks new, so that's a bonus, I think.
I love that.
My work is all around working with women to get them to a place where they have more wardrobe satisfaction with what they already own. So in the time that I've been doing my wardrobe free, so it's almost 260 days now, what I've realized is that for me, the dopamine gets ignited in my brain when I find a new outfit combination, as opposed to buying something new. When I find another, like, absolutely banging outfit combination in the wardrobe that I already have, it gives me so much joy and so much satisfaction. And working with other women to help them achieve those kind of, like, fuck yes moments with stuff that they've already spent time, money, and energy on is really, like, it feels really powerful. And also just being authentic to yourself, like wearing what you want to wear regardless of what the outside world is telling you, gives you a feeling of authenticity and comfort over any trend could ever give you. And it also gives other people and other women the permission to do the same. The more you are yourself truly and in every way that you can be, the more we can let go of needing to be on trend, needing that to make us feel worthy and just be worthy because we are.
In line with that, but along the lines of that authenticity piece, dressing for our own authentic selves and wearing what we like, not what fast fashion and social media is telling us we should like. I think that is super challenging for probably a lot of us. A lot of us find that really challenging, is knowing who we even are to start with.
Mm, especially if you're trying to figure that authenticity piece out with being bombarded visually and even in your day-to-day life with what I should look like or be or do or have. It's a real flip, like to figure out, to slow down, to allow who you are to emerge, which is the natural way of life and life cycles, versus this, I think it comes back to productivity and linear progress and outcomes and efficiency and effectiveness. Those things are all of capitalism and of the patriarchy and emergence and spaciousness and letting things come and come from within naturally. They're not things that are valued in the current culture.
No.
And I think in the work that I do, I talk about, you know, the heroine pieces within people's wardrobes, women's wardrobes, and they're the pieces that make us feel amazing, the ones that make us feel powerful, the one that make us feel like we are the outward embodiment of who we really are inside. And what I found with working with all these different women is that those pieces really hang in our wardrobes the most. So we don't wear them. And it's like, do we need the permission to wear them? Because I feel like the heroine pieces in our wardrobes, and we all know what they are without even thinking. Like I'm saying the words to you and you're thinking, yep, it's that, and that. And it's like, we don't wear them. Why? Why don't we wear them? They're the ones that make us feel the best.
Because they're also the scariest. They're also the scariest, yes. Right? So I think that's the thing, is that they're this wonderful piece that reflects a part of ourselves that we love and we really honour and that makes us feel very enlivened and alive. But also, I think we talked about that whole visibility piece, is that it's also, we probably have patterns from childhood and just from lived experience where stepping into the authenticity meant we had to make a choice between being authentic and belonging, and probably more often than not for safety, and we chose belonging. So as we are encouraged to be authentic, we're also not, it's not talked about how to find safety in being authentic.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you have those incredible pieces and you don't wear them every day, because it's almost like, oh, only when I feel bold enough can I put that on.
But in fashion psychology, there's so much that says dress for the job you want, not the job you have, kind of mentality. Like when we wear them, they make us feel that way as well. So sometimes it is, and I really hate this phrase, but like the fake it till you make it, putting those items on is going to give us more satisfaction overall with our wardrobes and help us to buy less, because we are feeling like what we are wearing is aligned with who we are. And I absolutely understand where you're coming from in that kind of like that fear piece, because obviously I feel it too, and my clients feel it, and we as women feel it. But it's like, in order to try and flip this patriarchy to a matriarchy, which is what needs to happen to save the planet, in my opinion, like we need to start showing up like that with the fear, but just like, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway, because like I said, if I do it, someone else can do it.
So I think it's finding those ways to step into authenticity and be with the fear without suppressing it or pushing it away or pushing through it. And I think that's the pivotal change piece, is like, well, how do I be authentic and also allow fear to be there? Because if we suppress it, it's just going to come back. It's in some other way. How do we find that way? And there are various tools out there. So it's this sort of having the self-compassion and having the grounded confidence at the same time to step into those, wearing those pieces. And I think that's the work of women, for women stepping forward to make this change, absolutely, like you said, Hazel.
And I love that you're here, Viv, to bring the nuance to my just sweeping statements. Like, I love that.
I was like, I hope I brought the nuance
inside, but it's not, it's so much more nuanced than that. So thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. The same thing. Like when I work with clients, it's like the feeling they have. So if they're like fearful, and then I ask them, what do they want to feel it instead? Like what's like the opposite? And then we like work on like a small significant step to sort of reframe that pattern. Because it's an everyday exercise and it's not just like in consumption, it's anything. Like I talk to people about if you're worried about negotiating, like practice negotiating. So you can practice like the opposite of your fear
in really daily. Small ways. And that has been the piece for me that's made a big difference is it's not a big grand gesture of like standing up to my biggest fear and dancing with some snakes or something crazy. But it's like, what is the just noticeable difference that you could make? And I feel like this with purchasing or with anything else, it's like, what is the smallest, like, again, coming back to that ease, sense of ease, what is the smallest difference or smallest change that you could make that almost feels effortless? And you're like, that's not enough. I haven't done enough of a change. And it's building on those really micro kind of actions. And then you look back in 6 months' time, you're like, holy fuck, I've completely changed how I shop.
Yeah, because that's what it is. Like you're compounding the experience, but that's what it is with your finances. You're actually exercising a muscle because moving a dollar to a savings account is progress. You're exercising something, like you're automating, you're doing it for you. You have a goal. It's not the amount. It doesn't have to be like $1 million in a year. It's like these little steps because the time is going to pass anyway. And like a little step in, if you're talking about a fashion, it's just like wearing the earrings that you have. It doesn't have to be a macro thing. It's micro, like little steps for you. Not absolutely. Like everything we listed. Unrealistic.
And also like the research shows that like with people suffering from things like compulsive buying disorder, having a small setback actually makes them just give up completely. So having those tiny, small, tangible steps can help in that like pull and shove of oh, I've fucked up, so I can't possibly go on now.
It stops the all or nothing mentality and also the goal setting stuff that's like set, the big goal. So I've always found that kind of goal setting completely paralyzing and I've never, ever successfully executed that.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful author called Oliver Berkman who wrote 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And he wrote an article about his friend saying to him, oh, you're not still thinking that you're going to arrive somewhere, right? And it's this sense that we live not in the moment, but in we're longing for when we're going to arrive and actually dropping this idea that we're ever going to arrive anywhere. And even if we did arrive where we wanted to arrive, we'd be looking for the next place to arrive at. And it's so important because we're living only now. We're not living in the future. We're not living in the past. We're only living in the now. And we wish away so much of the now with the big aspirational goals.
I love that. It's that feeling of like when I'm different, like in 6 months when I'm a different human, not the
that's
one
the
I am
arrival.
Now.
Yep. when I arrive at the 10 kilos lighter, when I arrive at the looking glamorous because I've purchased all of these clothes, it's like no matter wherever you go, you're still going to be there with those longings and desires.
It's just you.
And that's a wrap for part two. Once again, a huge thank you to our amazing panelists. For our listeners, make sure to mark your calendars for the final episode in this series, which is coming out on Friday. We'll be exploring the question, why do we keep outsourcing our style to fast fashion instead of focusing on what we already have? It's a big question and it'll provide valuable insights into your relationship with clothing and style. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to Reloved Radio. You can find the show notes from today's episode on the website www.relovedradio.com.au. And that's also where you can download my handpicked list of places to shop secondhand online in Australia. It features over 85 of the best online op shops, charity stores, vintage specialists, secondhand retailers, pre-loved luxury and designer fashion, ex-rental sales, and more. And it's free to download.